coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. The Super Bowl has always been a huge sports betting day, but will likely be even bigger this year with full sports gambling now available outside Nevada, in Delaware, and other states.
It's building momentum. We haven't seen too many large wagers or anything, but as each day goes by, they're more and more wagers are being made.
We check in on how the first state's doing just over 6 months into full sports betting with Delaware Lottery Director Vernon Kirk. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We also take a closer look at how parents can keep track of their teens and tweens' digital lives. Our latest arts playlist introduces us to a Dover native coming home with a Broadway show playing in Wilmington. And we examine the maternal health challenges Delaware faces in this week's Enlighten Me. It's all next on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. The Super Bowl is not just a big football game. It's also a huge day for sports gambling. Last year, a record $158 million plus dollars was bet legally on Super Bowl 52 at Nevada sportsbooks. This year, Nevada is no longer alone. Delaware and other states are now legally allowed to offer a full menu of sports betting, and experts suggest this year's NFL title game could be the most wagered on sporting event ever, with perhaps over $320 million bet. But how is sports betting working out for the first state beyond big events like the Super Bowl? Well, since last June, when Delaware became the first state beyond Nevada to legalize full-scale sports betting after the Supreme Court lifted a federal ban on it, it's generated about $87 million in bets at the state's three casinos. To help put that number into context and dig deeper into sports betting's impact here, Delaware Public Media's Nick Schellino recently spoke with Vernon Kirk, director of the Delaware Lottery, which runs Delaware's sports betting operation.
Well, it's been a pretty big deal for everybody concerned, primarily because we have done so well in the football season. But the risk management has been really right on, and we've done a little bit better than others had anticipated in things like baseball and hockey and basketball. So it's been very profitable.
Has football been the most profitable?
It has. I can't parse out the dollar amount, but the dollars bet has been considerable. When you count the retailers and their parlay cards and the straight betting on pro football and also college football, so it's been considerable.
And with the parlay cards, I know it's no longer the case that you have to bet on three separate games. You can now make side bets, and you can even make side bets on one single game. Has that been very popular? Has the parlay cards been affected by the legalization of full-scale sports betting on football games?
Well, I have to confess, I thought it would be more impacted than it has been, and I think one of the reasons why is that we've offered the college football on the parlay card as well as pro football, and that gives our retailers an opportunity to sell on Saturdays and Sundays or have games on Saturdays and Sundays. But it is true that the being able to mix and match three events as opposed to three separate games has been good also. For numbers, for instance, last year, the retailers sold about $29.4 million worth of cards. This year, to date, they've sold 30.6. So rather than go down, it's actually gone up about 4%.
Well, that's not exactly what you would expect. I know there were efforts here locally to allow for sports betting at the racetrack during NASCAR events. Was that very popular?
Not in the overall scheme of things. It was popular at the track with a lot of fans, et cetera. But from a dollar point of view, it was pretty modest compared to things like football and stuff. But it was a popular for the race fans that were actually at the race, as it were. Auto racing does not nab a whole bunch of money. So
How much of an uptick has the NFL playoffs generated compared to the regular season?
Well, it's traditionally the because the number of selections available begin to diminish, then the retailers don't have as many options, and so sales and there's not so many options for the straight bettors to select from, so sales generally go down, which they have. But that's just a natural phenomena of fewer choices. But the state continues to do well, and our hold percentage has been very strong, not just all season, but also throughout the playoffs.
That's interesting. You'd think that since the playoffs are more widely watched, that there'd be more betting. But you're saying that since there's less games to choose from, people tend to not bet as much.
Yes, it would be maybe not, you know, not as many people bet maybe, or not as much money. Just, you know, when there's more selections available, there's a lot more wagering going on. So it's a lot better this year than last year, to be sure. But it still is, especially with the retailers, has gone down a fair amount to, as would be predicted for this, but they have a lot of choices to make, and we've worked really hard to give them ways to continue to participate. For example, we have a half point proposition parlay card this year for just the championship game alone, that has a dozen different selections on it for the retailers customers to choose from, to keep the retailers in the mix right up through the end of the Super Bowl. So right now that's doing well. It will continue to do better as the week and weekend progresses, but right now it's doing well. The casinos have the same card available, although it's not quite as popular at the casinos, but it is used. The casinos have an additional 53 proposition bets they can make on the championship game with the single game wagering. So it'll be interesting to see exactly how much is bet on the Super Bowl this year.
Yeah, definitely. So in addition to those half point cards, are you seeing a lot of straight bets already for the Super Bowl?
It's building momentum. We haven't seen too many large wagers or anything, but as each day goes by, there are more and more wagers are being made. And by the time we get to this weekend, Saturday and Sunday, or Friday for that matter, it should be very, very strong.
And what are the odds for the Super Bowl?
Well, right now the Patriots are slight favorites, less than a field goal. The wagering has been pretty much even on both sides. I will tell you this, we always even in the past, have offered a future wagers on the football, pro football championship that begin in August during the exhibition season, and you can bet right up until the playoffs. And this year we did about $409,000 on futures bets, and the state is in a winning position regardless of which team actually win Super Bowl. The state wins about $150,000if New England wins, and the state wins about $164,000 if the Rams win. So that's been pleasant. Last year we kind of got beat up when the Eagles won.
Well, that's a good deal for the state. They can't lose. Do you have any money on the game?
I'm not allowed.
Oh, you're not allowed. Well, no. Is there anything else you'd like to add that maybe we didn't go over?
No, I think that about covers it. We've had a phenomenally good year, and the risk manager gets a lot of credit for that, and the retailers and the casinos get a lot of credit. We just had a very, very strong year, and I look forward to basketball and March Madness.
Thanks to Delaware Lottery Director Vernon Kirk and Arnick Shalino for joining us on The Green this week to talk sports betting. And good luck if you've got some money on the Super Bowl. Next on The Green, we look at how parents these days handle monitoring what their kids do on their phones and online, and if they're on the right track. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. These days, kids are getting phones at a younger and younger age and using them and other devices to live an increasingly digital life. That leaves parents with a dilemma. How can they make sure their children live that digital life safely and responsibly? In some cases, parents are turning to technology to help them. But where's the line drawn between keeping tabs on your kid and invading their privacy? We asked contributor Eileen Dalabrida to delve into this issue, and what she found is in her latest piece, available right now at DelawarePublic.org. And she joined me earlier this week to chat about it. Maybe a few years ago, parents may have tried to simply just kind of hold off on giving their kids a phone or access to certain websites. But your piece indicates studies show parents are now kind of accepting it and actually more likely to engage with their kids about being online. What do we know about kind of where things stand now?
Well, kids are getting phones at a younger age, and part of it is because they are asking for it and truly want phones, and also because I think the parents actually appreciate this technology that is enabling them to stay closer in touch with their kids.
And I said there was a Pew study that showed that a lot of parents are actually talking about it, that they are, as I said, kind of engaging on this.
Yeah, 94% of parents, most parents who have teens or tweens, talk about what is acceptable and unacceptable to share online. And they have these conversations, and they talk about stranger danger and things like that. But not as many follow up on it.
Well, that's what I was going to say. Digging deeper into that Pew study, there's indications that many don't kind of take that next step. They talk about it. They keep the lines of communication open, but they're not actually kind of monitoring things. What did the Pew study show about parents kind of really digging in and really keeping track?
Well, 61% of parents check their kids' browser history. They check out what websites their kids are visiting. So, and then about only 60% have even read their kids' profiles on their social media accounts.
Wow.
And a little bit more than half have friended their kids or followed them on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, other social media channels. And fewer than half have checked up on their teens' text messages or the logs on their phones.
And this kind of monitoring is important, according to experts, right, to be engaged at that level.
It is. I mean, they don't call it the World Wide Web for nothing. And parents should check in on what their kids are posting. The experts tell us.
And I guess the key there is the idea that if you're going to talk about it, you should know specifically what you're talking about. And you did find one family that they kind of learned firsthand about the importance of monitoring their kids' activities. Can you tell us a little bit about their story?
Yeah, there's a family in Claymont, and I think they're a pretty typical family. And they have been very diligent about keeping tabs on their young daughter's cell phone use. One of their daughters is 14, and the other one is 12. And they have Instagram accounts. It's the only social media that they're permitted to post on. And once a day, their mom checks and sees what the girls are up to online. Well, the older daughter made a friend who said that she was 13 years old through Instagram, and they were texting back and forth. And the mom doesn't recognize this kid's phone number. She's like, who is this kid? And the daughter says, well, I've never spoken to her, but I met her through Instagram, so she must be okay. Well, she wasn't. The mom did some checking and was able to track the alleged 13-year-old girl to her Facebook page and discovered that it was a 35-year-old man.
Yeah, that is definitely a cautionary tale right there. But unfortunately one that we hear far too often about. So there you see a family that's kind of engaged and kind of checking up and looking at the Instagram and also looking at the text and kind of keeping, you know, tabs on the whole picture. If parents really want to monitor closely, there's also apps, right, that can help them do that. You don't just have to do it the way that family did by persistently checking yourself. Can you tell us about some of these apps that help, you know, parents kind of keep tabs on what's going on with their kids and even where they are?
Yeah, tracking apps like Find a Friend and Glimpse allow the users to locate their connections. And it's a tough one because there are kids who don't want their parents to always know where they are. And then there are younger kids who the younger kids seem to be more okay with it. But in this particular family that we were talking about, it goes both ways. So the girls know where mom and dad are, and mom and dad know where they are. So it's there's some equity there. It isn't just Big Brother watching them. We also know, and we interviewed a psychologist from the Moores who talks about kids who have misbehaved and having these conversations that, you know, you've been in trouble and you've let us down. So we do need to keep an eye on you and make sure that you are where you say you are. And when after you've demonstrated that we can trust you, we'll revisit this issue.
Yeah, and I guess your story also kind of points out that these apps are also helpful, you know, maybe not just for your parents' peace of mind, but if you have a child who has health issues or something like that, that having the ability to kind of have a better idea of where they are at any given time is also a pretty positive thing.
It is. The psychologist has talked with us about kids who have type 1 diabetes or have other chronic conditions, and they feel that it's an extra layer of safety, both the kids and the parents.
But as you kind of alluded to, I mean, there is kind of a risk here, right, that parents can go a little too far in monitoring and maybe their kids, you know, because of that, rebel, push back. You know, how big a risk is that, you know, according to the people you talk to, that kids, if they feel like they're being monitored too much, actually try to beat the system?
Yeah, they do. And kids are really good at this. I think as kids get older, that there's more pushback on this, and nobody likes to be spied on, so they don't think of it as being monitored, or they think of it as being spied on or snooping. So it's a very slippery slope, and that is one of the reasons why having conversations between parents and kids is so important, to say, you know, there are rules. We're just not going to give you a phone and let you do whatever you want with it. There need to be some guidelines, some boundaries, and we are your parents, and it's our job.
Yeah, it's good. It seems like it's not new, the idea of this kind of like striking a balance and like having clear rules. But what's different is that, you know, back when I was a kid, you know, you would be mad if your parent was like snooping in your room and going through your desk drawers, or if you kept a diary, trying to read your diary and find out what's going on. This is a little bit different because it's online and it's kind of reaching out into the world, which makes it, I guess, a little bit more complex than perhaps it was 20, 30 years ago.
Yeah. If a 35-year-old could not pretend to be a 13-year-old girl, the technology did not support that. Back when we were kids, so because it is so far flung, and because there is a good measure of anonymity through some of these sites and social media, that it's just more complicated.
Did the expert you talked to have any kind of specific suggestions for striking that right balance and kind of making it work where, you know, you can get your child's buy-in as much as possible with a teen or a tween?
Yes. That it's rewards and consequences that having a phone is a privilege, and it is that there a large number of parents use the phone as a carrot that says you have to keep this grade point average, or you're going to be digitally grounded, or if you behave badly, give me the phone, that kind of thing. And it's, but I think my takeaway from talking with the psychologist is that it's conversation. It's not just saying, this is the way it is, like it or lump it. It's talking about what benefit there are to kids and parents in being transparent in using social media.
And it can happen. As you alluded to earlier, the family you talked to seem to have found that right balance, right?
Yeah. I mean, the kids are with the program, and the parents are a united front. And it's worked out really well for them.
Thanks to contributor Eileen Dalabrida for her time on The Green this week. Her piece on parents keeping tabs on their kids' online lives is available right now at DelawarePublic.org. And stay with us. We meet a Dovernator returning home as part of a show coming to the Playhouse on Rodney Square in Wilmington. That's this week's Arts Playlist, and it's next on The Green here on Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. How Peter Became Pan is the premise of a show coming to the Playhouse on Rodney Square in Wilmington, February 7th through February 10th. Finding Neverland is the Broadway musical that follows playwright J.M. Barrie's struggles to write a new show after his current show plays to half-empty houses. One of the stars of the upcoming show is Dover native Connor McGiffin, who will play Captain Hook and the man who inspired the character, Charles Frohman. In this week's Arts Playlist, Delaware Public Media's Kelly Steele chats with McGiffin about the musical and his career.
Hey, give me a little bit of background before we tell people about the name of the show and tell people about the show. What's your background?
Well, I was born and raised in Dover, Delaware. I started acting when I was 8 at the Children's Theater of Dover. I then started taking dance classes at the Dance Conservatory, and then I ended up going to college for musical theater. I got a BFA from the University of Michigan, and then I headed to New York after I graduated in 2014, and I've been working as an actor ever since. This is going to be my 5th national tour, and I was very lucky to be invited to audition for the role of Charles Frohman and Captain Hook for Finding Neverland. And it's ended up being one of the most fulfilling artistic experiences I could have ever asked for.
You must have gotten started when you were fairly young, yes?
Yes, when I was 8 years old. Mm-hmm.
What drew you to acting and the arts?
Well, it's all started sort of as a nighttime activity for my sister. She started doing children's theater first, and then my mom would bring me along, and then I shared some sort of interest to it. So I actually bombed my first audition. It was for The Wizard of Oz, and the idea was that we were all supposed to stand up on the stage and say one line, and then I think it was just one of the Scarecrow's lines, and then we would all get cast based on our ability just to say a line. I failed pretty miserably, and then my mom said, "You know, if you want to do it one more time, I won't blame you. But if you really don't like it after this next time, then we don't have to do it again." Luckily, it was a Babes in Toyland, and we all had to go on stage and prove that we could sing. And in the time between the two auditions, I went to, I hung out with my mom when she was helping out the musical at her high school that she was teaching at. It was Bye Bye Birdie. And so I would be listening to all these high school students sing. And I think I sort of gleaned some stuff off of them and got on stage and was able to carry a tune. And now I'm here.
All right. So you sing, you act. Do you dance?
I do, yes.
I'd ask you to dance for me, but we can't see that on radio, so we'll skip that part.
No worries. That is all good.
All right, so let's talk about this new show you're starring in. Again, it's coming to the Playhouse on Rodney Square in Wilmington, February 7th through 10th. It's called Finding Neverland. Going to be very exciting. Tell us about Finding Neverland.
Sure. Well, Finding Neverland is the story about how Peter became Pan. J.M. Barrie is struggling to write a new show after his current show is playing to half-empty houses in the theater. And he's in a park trying to find some inspiration. And he ends up running into this family called the Llewellyn Davies family. And the four boys and the mother, Sylvia, go on to inspire him to create this show for children. Now, he's never written a show for children before, and his producer, the part that I play, is very wary about that. So the source of conflict is between what everybody expects of him, like myself and his wife and the townspeople, and what he really wants and what he thinks is going to help him. And he ends up, well, I don't want to give too much away, but he ends up really thriving with this new show, and it ends up being, as you may know, a massive success that people today know about.
How many people tried out for this role?
Oh, man. You know, it varies. It's hard to say. I once heard that there is an average of at least 600 people trying to trying out for one role. So it could have been that, it could have been more, it could have been less.
You must feel very honored, though, to have gotten the role as Captain James Hook.
Yes, I am. I feel very, it's been a role that I've wanted to play for a very long time, actually.
Now,
Captain Hook has sort of eluded me for a very long time, and I finally got him.
As a kid, of course, like many children, I've seen Peter Pan when I was a child. I've never seen Finding Neverland, but does Captain Hook sing at all in this?
Yes, he does.
Do you want to sing us a little ditty? Are you prepared to do that?
Well, it is a little early on this side. I'm in Springfield, Missouri right now. But,
oh, lucky you. Okay. All right.
Promise you, if you come see the show, you'll be able to see. You'll be able to hear everything.
We'll let you off the hook this time. Hey, Connor, talk to me about, we've talked about your background and how you got started. Talk a little bit about your aspirations a bit and who you may admire in life or use as a role model for your acting career.
Of course. Well, my aspiration is simply just to be able to raise a family as an actor. That's what I've always wanted to do. I've always, where I've worked doesn't matter, whether my career takes me to Los Angeles or keeps me in New York or takes me to Vancouver. I just have wanted to do it. I've just wanted to be an actor and have success with it. My inspirations, I mean, I grew up on it watching Whose Line Is It Anyway? And Inside the Actor's Studio in tandem with each other. So it would be, you know, Colin Mochrie, Ryan Stiles, and Wayne Brady. And then it'd also be Robert De Niro and Al Pacino and Meryl Streep and Robin Williams, which is a beautiful marriage of the two. So anybody who can do, basically anyone who can do both comedy and high drama and Shakespeare and Ibsen and poetry and just someone who can do it all. Those are the people that I really glean to.
All right, since I let you off the hook for your singing, I'm going to put you on the spot again. What has your most favorite character been over the years?
Oh, my goodness. Well, I'm afraid I can't just pick one, but the ones that come to mind right now are Billy Flynn from Chicago. I understudied the role of the Dysquith family in the musical A Gentleman's Guide to Love and Murder. And I think I have a really soft spot for my first show that I was ever cast in professionally, which was Thoroughly Modern Millie. I was in the ensemble of that, and that experience was just absolutely thrilling, and that show is so much fun. So I'd say those three.
I can hear a passion in your voice. What is in Connor McGriffin's future?
Oh, well, gosh, you know, I hope it's an equity contract. I hope it's a show in New York City. In fact, I'm going to try to will that into existence in the universe. It's going to be a show in New York, or a pilot, or a voiceover role. It's going to be that.
Now, you are a Dover native. Where do you reside now? When you're not, I'm sure you're traveling all the time, all over the place. But where do you call home?
I call New York home. I live up at the tip top of Manhattan called Inwood, and it is a beautiful part of the city.
Wow, that sounds good. Anything else I haven't asked you about Finding Neverland and your role as Captain James Hook that you want the public to know about that will get them out to this show?
Mm-hmm. Well, sure. It definitely is a show for people of all ages, children of all ages, if you wanted to put it that way. It's got beautiful score that'll get right into your brain, and it won't leave you for quite some time. It has an amazing crew behind the scenes, so our technical elements are just fabulous, and your eye will never be bored. And finally, the ensemble has this amazing ability with the choreography, which is incredibly difficult, that has been given to them. It's Mia Michael's choreography, one of the choreographers from So You Think You Can Dance, and it's incredibly difficult, and these dancers handle it with ease and a grace that is so spectacular. So if you love dance, if you love, stage magic, and if you love pop music, come on down to Finding Neverland.
Thanks to actor and Dover native Connor McGiffin and our Kelly Steele for joining us in this week's Arts Playlist. Tickets to Finding Neverland at the Playhouse on Rodney Square in Wilmington are available at thegrandwilmington.org. And stay with us. Enlighten Me is next, featuring a conversation on maternal health challenges here in the First State. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green this week. I'm Tom Byrne. The Delaware section of the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists recently hosted its first Maternal Health Awareness Day in the First State. And in this week's Enlighten Me, Delaware Public Media's Sophia Schmidt talks with the group's leader about ongoing challenges to maternal health in Delaware.
OBGYN Dr. Gordon Ostrom practices at Christiana Hospital and is the chair of the Delaware section of the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists. Governor John Carney signed a proclamation last week naming January 23rd Maternal Health Awareness Day. Ostrom says it's important to raise awareness about maternal health because it is integral to overall population health and often misunderstood.
Well, there's no question that maternal health is entree to all health. That's where babies start, and that's where we can start making an impact on public health in general. We in ACOG are women's health care physicians and advocates, and we consider ourselves stewards of excellent health care for our expectant mothers, our non-pregnant females, our population in general. But by extension, that stewardship will translate to better health care for everyone, for the family, the extended family, and the community. So the maternal health awareness piece has really risen to the fore recently because I think we tended to overlook the fact that there are continuing issues with maternal health. we all know the quote-unquote wonders of modern medicine and science and so forth have made our lives so much easier and better. Life expectancy has increased. And these are all things that maybe lull us into a sense of complacency. And when we look around us, we see that there are still significant complications associated with pregnancy and childbearing, both for the mother and, of course, for the baby. These are disparate in regards to their frequency in different demographic groups, but they're alarming in all across all demographic groups. So with that in mind, we have decided as a college to make people more aware of not only maternal morbidity and mortality, but also the need for maternal health and to advocate for that primarily.
Ostrom says much of maternal health during and after pregnancy comes down to the timing of appointments.
In general, what has been recognized is that as many as 50% of women do not come back for their suggested postpartum follow-up. And that number is somewhat skewed by demographic considerations as well. By educating people, we can encourage them to come back and achieve the care that they should be getting. Additionally, it has been recognized that we can decrease readmissions after delivery, which are costly, are detrimental to the health, and can often be avoided if you set up earlier postpartum, post-delivery follow-up, rather than the traditional 6 weeks, which has always been used. We're now suggesting that people with elevated blood pressure, for example, be evaluated within 3 to 5 days of their discharge from the hospital. And it has been proven that that can decrease maternal readmissions significantly. Again, less of an impact on the neonatal outcome, although obviously child care to people who are readmitted is a significant problem.
But is lack of understanding really the only thing keeping women from their postpartum appointments?
Education is certainly a part of it, and it's education not just of the patient, but also the provider. Insurance considerations are a problem because many insurance carriers are reluctant to reimburse for care outside of that six-week visit that we spoke about. Mm-hmm. So there are initiatives involving insurers to help them understand that this is money well spent because it may prevent more significant problems in the future. And I think improving access to transportation is certainly another issue because many people have trouble getting back to the hospital even if they are interested in getting there.
Ostrom says poverty can be a barrier to women's health, but it's not the only barrier.
Delaware, in general, is underserved by women's health care physicians. If you look at the numbers of actively practicing physicians, confound that with the point that that is very geographically determined. Obviously, Newcastle County has way more women's health providers than Kent and Sussex, absent the beach area. Mm-hmm. So there are definitely opportunities to have outreach centers and improve opportunities there. And here that you had asked before for an example, well, consider yourself coming from Sussex County, wherever, with a complicated pregnancy that was referred to Christiana for ultimate management and delivery. You're sent home. Where do you go? I mean, the people in Sussex County, maybe you didn't have a provider there. It's a trek for you to come up 2 hours to Christiana to achieve your care. So those are opportunities where we can coordinate follow-up from a public health standpoint. But we do have our, I'm sure you're aware of DIN, which is the Delaware Health Information Network. So the information's out there, but the ability to coordinate with providers and outpatient facilities would be another step that we can take.
A focus of the recent Maternal Health Awareness Day in Delaware was what some OBGYNs call the fourth trimester.
Well, that's, it's obviously a little bit of wordsmithing. And obviously, trimester does suggest three, but that has been the impetus for this concept. One of our speakers, Dr. Haywood Brown, who is the immediate past president of ACOG, kind of coined this term and has run with it. And what it means is don't ignore that postpartum period and the importance of maintaining health. And it kind of translates from the fourth trimester to interpregnancy care and the ability to optimize medical conditions when you're not pregnant. So for the next pregnancy, you'll be in the best possible condition to go through the stresses of pregnancy. Helping to plan pregnancy, pregnancy spacing. We know now that the optimal time is probably 18 plus months between deliveries. So those are things we can offer our patients, the ability to postpone pregnancy. And Delaware is very fortunate. They've been very proactive in making contraception available to everyone. The Delaware Can Initiative and the upstream people have been great promoting LARCs. Are you familiar with LARCs, long-acting reversible contraceptives, IUDs, implants, injections, so forth? And that, of course, better pregnancy spacing, better outcomes, better health to all involved. And we are also looking at screening for other medical illnesses, blood pressure, diabetes. In point of fact, many women use their OBGYNs as their primary care physicians, and we are considered primary care because many people who are otherwise healthy don't see their primary cares except for I've got the sniffles or whatever. So by seeing people on a regular basis for reproductive care and contraceptive advice and so forth, we have an opportunity to say, have you had your cholesterol checked? What's your blood pressure doing? What's your family history? So we are certainly taking advantage of that, again, trying to optimize people's care between pregnancies as well. And hopefully, as I say, I hate to always ignore the rest of the population. These are habits that should spread from our ladies to everyone around them.
Ostrom says behavioral factors like opioid addiction or depression can play large roles in maternal health. He thinks good communication between OBGYNs and patients is key to setting up referrals to ensure better care going forward.
After this meeting we had last week, and I've always been a little bit willing or very willing to do this, but I've been thinking, yeah, you know, really, there's not much I'm doing here. Your pressure's fine. Baby sounds good. Everything's good. How are you? What's going on with you? And I think if we remind people to do that, we'll be more attentive to everything.
That was Dr. Gordon Ostrom, chair of the Delaware section of the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists and practicing OBGYN at Christiana Hospital. I'm Sophia Schmidt, Delaware Public Media.
Thanks to Christiana Hospital's Dr. Gordon Ostrom and our Sophia Schmidt for enlightening us about maternal health this week. And that's all we have time for on this week's edition of The Green. The stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. And remember, you can also check out The Green via podcast at our website, on iTunes, and on the NPR One app. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page, on Twitter at TheGreenDE, or by emailing us at TheGreen@DelawarePublic.org. Thanks to all those who helped make today's show possible, contributor Eileen Dalabrida, and Delaware Public Media's Nick Shalino, Sophia Schmidt, and Kelly Steele. For all of them, and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Byrne saying thanks for joining us this week, and we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground.